Hi, today's April 21st, 2019, and this is Movies Podcast number 292. I'm Todd Ugasawara with my friend John Westfall, back after a brief hiatus last weekend. John and I were just commenting before I turned on the record button that there isn't a whole heck of a lot going on here this week, tech-wise anyway. There's a lot going on everything else-wise, but not so much tech-wise.
We have a lot going on. We just, you know, limit ourselves here to tech.
So. There you go. That's exactly right. So the first thing I have is a tip. It's not much of a tip, but here you go. So, you know, I typically use a Chromebook as my daily driver at home. Rarely boot up a Windows box. In fact, I can't remember last time I booted a Windows box up at home. And the Mac gets booted up on the weekends once or twice, depending on how many podcasts I record. And that's about it. The rest of the time I'm on Chromebook or on an iPad. So one of the interesting things is, and I should also say, I use a Lenovo Smart Display, which is a Google Home Assistant device with a screen. Really like that for, you know, quick kind of tasks. But one thing I noticed is that I can't cast from the Chrome browser in a Chromebook made by Google. Well, the Chromebook's made by Samsung, but you know what I mean. The OS is made by Google to a Lenovo Smart Display. And that's kind of weird because I can do it from Chrome on an iPhone. I can do it from Android, but not from a Chromebook. But what I found out is, just by accident, you know, because I just didn't bother thinking about it much until this morning. I have the Google's Play Movies and TVs app, which is part of the Google Play system. And I can which is an Android app, and I can cast from it. So I said, hey, I'll install the Android YouTube app on my Chromebook, since many Chromebooks these days can run Android apps. And sure enough, I installed the YouTube app, and I can cast to the Smart Display. Now, casting to the Smart Display is an iffy proposition. There are a number of things that go on that sometimes it doesn't work. I would say it works maybe half the time, maybe a little bit more. It's not really a reliable way of doing things. But that said, at least I can do it now. So, you know, I know how to cast from a Chromebook to a Smart Display, and a Google Smart Display, a Google Home Assistant with a display, I should say. Now, why would I want to do that? Because sometimes I just want to watch, you know, something on YouTube, often news, and do something else with a full screen on a Chromebook. And it's really nice to basically have a second screen to stream to show something else. Now, you could say, well, can't the Smart Display just show YouTube on its own without casting? And the answer is yes. But quite frankly, searching with your voice is not the fastest and most reliable way to find a video you want to see. So, you can do it, but honestly, it's easier with a keyboard. Anyway, so that's my tip. Go download the Android apps that, like Google Play, TV and Movies, or Google's YouTube app for Android, and you can cast from your Chromebook. So there you go.
Very good.
Yeah. All right, John, I have one or two other things, but why don't you go ahead?
Well, so one of the things that I become very interested in this time of year is WWDC is coming up, and Google also does their developer stuff. Microsoft usually slips something in. So we're getting into, like, peak developer season, and I came across a rumor roundup for iOS 13. Now, iOS 13 is, in my opinion, something that Apple has to make a little bit of a splash with, because we've been getting these very boring iOS releases for the last couple of years. Now, that's not to say that there's not good features in them. I think every release has had some, you know, at least one really cool feature, even if it takes forever to roll out, or just something that was kind of nice. But I think this has to be somewhat interesting, because remember, iOS 10 was a big refresh, and then we were told that iOS 11 was just fixing all the things that were broken in iOS 10. And then iOS 11 was, or 12 was supposed to be a bunch of cool new stuff, but then iOS, 12 was more fixing the stuff that iOS 11 didn't fix. So the rumors for 13 are looking a little bit interesting, but not as interesting as we might hope. So a dark mode, system-wide dark mode. Yeah, I mean, I like the idea of dark mode, even though I can't get myself to use it. I tried dark mode for a while, and then it just never goes on. iPad tweaks. I don't know what half the tweaks are to my current iPad, like all the little gestures and all that, because I only use them every so often, and then I forget about them.
Yeah, same.
Redesigned home screen. If that's true, that would be interesting if we can get rid of the grid layout and actually customize our home screen a little bit. I would think that would be a pretty killer feature if Apple decided to allow it, but then it basically becomes Android-like. So we'll see about that. A revamped Files app? Well, of course, if we can actually get an actual file system, I think that would appease a lot of geeks. A lot of us have figured out workarounds for it, but again, okay. And then we move into that's just...
Files is mostly a Cloud Files app, though, isn't it? Really, it should be called Cloud Files.
Yeah, so if it was actually an on-device Files app, that would be pretty cool. But who knows? And then we move into things that are really just boring. New gestures, updated volume, heads-up display, so instead of that giant thing in the middle. The Mail app, okay, some upgrades to that. Cross-platform iOS and Mac apps, maybe. And then, of course, new emoji, because...
You gotta have
always
emojis.
Emoji.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They got a skunk.
Yes. So, cool. And then the two little fingers pointing at something small, apparently. And really, the only two things that I'm really interested in, a new Find My iPhone app. There's some people are talking about how Apple might basically create their own tile tracking system and build it into one big app where you'd have Find My iPhone, Find My Friends, and tile-like item tracking add-in, which that could be kind of cool if it was all built in and done right. And then redesigned Reminders app. That would be great because the Reminders app now is pretty much worthless unless you have a very, very simplistic Reminders setup. But I don't know. None of this stuff was I looking at and going, wow, that's going to be a great WWDC in a little over a month.
But you know,
what are your thoughts?
Well, I was thinking about the Reminders app. It says a design, so they're not talking about functionality, right? It's more of a look and feel?
Well, here's the annoying thing about Reminders. Reminders is based on a standard, CalDAV, which supports a lot of things that the Reminders app doesn't expose. So, for example, CalDAV supports start and end dates. It supports due dates and start dates. It supports a few other things. The current Reminders app will let you set a reminder date, which is different. It won't actually let you set a true starter due date. And I think it limits you to just one reminder, whereas CalDAV supports multiple reminders. So I think there's a lot that could be done by just finding a good UI way that Apple likes to actually expose some of those things. Because right now, for example, I use an app called BusyCal. And the reason I use BusyCal really isn't because I like its calendar interface, although it's fine. It's because it supports editing things on the reminders on my Microsoft Outlook reminders that I can only do through Outlook. I can't do through Apple's Reminders app. So like adding a start or an end date and things like that. So I don't know. There's nothing that's really jumping out at me. June 3rd through 7th is WWDC, and I'm hoping that in that time some other cool stuff leaks, or that maybe they just have a really good handle on the rumor mill this year. But I don't know. I really need something interesting in the iOS ecosystem. Not that I'm going to give up iOS, because I'm pretty heavily invested, but I need something a little more than just it's prettier.
I wonder why Apple is doubling the live photo from 3 to 6 seconds. I mean, I'm pretty happy with the way live photo works right now. I didn't even realize it was 3 seconds. I thought it was like a fraction of a second.
Yeah, the thing I kind of don't like with live photo that I think would actually be really cool is if it showed you I'm trying to think of how you would visually do this, but you know, you've had, we all have had our open viewfinder, you know, we've been ready to snap photo. And you know now that if you see something really cool happen and you have live photos on, you hit that button almost immediately, you'll probably catch the cool thing that you just missed.
Right.
Because you'll get the second and a half beforehand and then the second and a half afterhand. But it would be really cool if there was some visual way. If you could extend it out to 3 seconds on either side of the picture and have like a visual, like a little light come on or something like that where you know this is, you know, if you press the button now, you're going to grab the last 3 seconds, or have a little timeline or something like that at the bottom, like a moving timeline.
Yeah,
I think that would make it really useful to shoot live photos, because then you would know, ooh, I still have time to grab that really cool thing that just happened that I didn't know was cool until 2 seconds later.
Yeah, like with animals and kids and things that move around a lot.
You know, the first time that your child says something intelligible and you didn't realize it was going to be intelligible until 2 seconds later. or the first time they were able to walk unassisted and you thought they weren't going to do it that time, so you didn't actually start taking the photo or anything. So, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm just kind of looking at that list you're talking through, and I'm like, new gestures. Like you said, I don't know the old gestures. The only thing I've learned is to move the cursor on my keyboard to 2 fingers. That's the most useful gesture.
Which I forget about that and all the time and then find it. There are 2 things that I will say, though. One, I just realized that you misspelled the name of the podcast in our show notes. It's pretty funny.
Podcats.
This is the Mobile Views Podcasts.
I like it.
That's a completely different thing we could do. I was thinking a lot about iOS over the last couple of weeks, specifically how it's changed in 10 years and how, you know, there's been great usability improvements, but they've been so gradual you would almost need to compare it side by side 10 years back, 10 years to today. So Apple does do a really great job of giving us improvements trickle down over time, but man, they're just not that exciting to talk about.
Yeah, you know, I will say a couple of things, though. One, the big, huge change from 10 to 11 was the move to all 64-bit apps in 11.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had to leave behind a lot of useful software. I think there was a network software that you had recommended to me at one time that, never made the move to 64-bits. It was a great, I can't remember the name anymore. And, of course, my favorite game, Civilization. Revolution never made the, leap across the chasm from 32 to 64 bits. So it will not run on 64, iOS 11 or 12. The one thing that's not on this list, and maybe it's not a iOS thing, so maybe it doesn't matter, but they don't talk about the camera app at all.
Yeah, that's true.
And one of the things iOS is lagging way behind Android is night mode. Or night sight, I forget what it's called. Mm-hmm. But that is, that on the Pixel, and I have an older Pixel, I have a Pixel 2. That is nothing short of amazing, to be able to take good, clear, sharp photos in very dim light conditions, like nighttime, 60-watt bulb, about, outdoor light fixture about 12, 13 feet away, and the resulting photo is rock solid. I mean, it's like, yes, that is a photo I'm happy with.
Solid enough that they will identify your killer that was sneaking up
in
the dark.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, that's the one thing I would say. And again, maybe it's not an iOS thing. Although when Google released it, it was a Google, Android thing. So they announced it as an Android feature, not, that the camera app was updated. Other than that, like you said, meh.
I'm sure there'll be something, and Apple finds ways of making the Mint seem awesome when they present it. But I don't know. I've had a lot of discussions lately with people where we talk about just the the really cool factor of previous generations, you know, like the first time you got a device that had GPS, or the first time you got a device that could do Wi-Fi. But now it's much less dramatic. But, you know, I will say, in their defense, the iPad now can do about 95% of my daily work. And that's kind of cool that I don't have to rely on MacBook or my Surface tablet for that. So.
Yeah. I will say I am happy to see a skunk emoji coming, just as an FYI. I have a soft spot in my heart for skunks. We used to have a neighborhood skunk when I was a kid. Used to come down from the hills and sort of, you know, stay at a safe but fairly close distance from we kids. Maybe, you know, 20 feet away, which is pretty, you know, and all except for one of us, who we later called Stinky, never chased it.
Stinky might have been a little bit unaware of exactly what skunks can do. So.
Well, I don't know about that. He was a pretty smart kid, but that one time, like, well, old Stinky.
Yeah,
so anyway, it was a lovely little neighborhood skunk. Never bothered anybody except for Stinky. Of course, Stinky bothered him first, so there you go.
You know, skunks just, ever since Looney Tunes hasn't been shown regularly to kids, and up with Pepe Le Pew, like, I don't think skunks have any positive, and Pepe Le Pew was not a positive role model for skunks in any way.
No.
He was, you know, basically kind of a positive stalker role model for wannabe sexual harassers, but I think that we've lost positive skunk role models, so I'm glad that there'll be an emoji for it. If for nothing else, that when people see a skunk, they can now express their outrage in pictorial form.
Yeah. And the skunk is not in a threatening posture or anything. You're just kind of standing there, tails up, so the skunk is alert, but not threatening, in my opinion. If you're chasing the tail to you, yes, that then you'd feel threatened. But at any rate, that means I am ready to roll. Okay, enough of the skunk emoji. They don't talk about new animojis, by the way.
Well, yeah, that's interesting, too. I've been using animoji quite a bit lately.
Have just you?
A dinosaur head on myself, you know, just to annoy people. But that's really me. I'm not really using animoji as it was designed in iOS 11 to take videos. I'm using mostly the camera effect that is like animoji.
Yeah, I just turned on message and I don't see anything. All right, I don't see anything new. At any rate, I haven't used it in a while. Okay, next up. You're at Tech Reminder.
Yeah, next up is one of those things. I have two things, a Tech Reminder and a cool app pick. The Tech Reminder is something that I did recently, and I thought, you know, this was really easy. Why have I not been doing this? Because it's kind of cool. And that is reminding people that Mail Merge, I think today we use Mail Merge a lot more for email than we use it for paper letters. I don't think people send as many letters as they used to. But when you combine Mail Merge with exporting to PDF, you actually can get a really nice result. So recently I was doing a bit of grading in one of my classes, and part of that was evaluating students' performance on a presentation.
Yeah.
And I had, I was rating it, and then I had a guest rater come in, and so I had their rating sheets of how they thought the person did, and there were a bunch of different dimensions, and so I loaded them all into a spreadsheet, and I thought, well, how am I going to give students feedback on this? I could just give them their total, but it would be kind of nice if they knew where they were on all the rankings. And I realized all I really have to do is make a pivot table in Excel that has by student their average on all the ratings, and then do a mail merge and take the rating form and just plug in the merge fields so that it shows, you know, your average, and then export all that to PDF. And that took about 5 minutes. You know, it's really not that much, but it produces something that looks really cool to an end user, you know, instead of just, oh, here's an email that's got my score in it. It's actually, here's a PDF that has my name. It has my scores right along the rating form that I saw before I ever took the presentation. So just a reminder, because I think I forget sometimes about how much you can leverage a lot of different Office things together. In this case, pivot tables in Excel, two mail merge.
Hmm.
In fact, I'm sure some people are probably wondering, can you put a pivot table in a mail merge? And of course you can. It works just like any other sheet in the spreadsheet. So that was something I thought was a cool reminder. I don't know how often you use mail merge or pivot tables.
I use pivot tables pretty frequently. Mail merge, I can't even remember the last time I used it. I'm literally trying to remember right now and I can't.
I think most of the time I use it, it's always for emails, to send out a bunch of emails with someone's first name in the, you know, the dear line or something like that, just to add a little bit of a personal touch to things.
Yeah.
But I always forget that, and I think the product that you get with this, it looks a lot more, it looks like you had to use some sort of custom software that produced this report for you, when in reality, you were just using Microsoft Office.
Yeah. And are you using the Mac version or the Windows version of Office?
Both, and you can do what I just described in both.
Okay. Because I remember that I haven't used the Mac version of Office in a long time, but they used to be slightly different.
You know? They are, and it's bizarre in how they're different, especially if you are on the insider builds.
Yeah.
Like I'm on my MacBook. There's some very strange little differences, and in some cases Windows is better, and in some cases Apple is better. So it's almost like the two product teams are not really thinking. It's kind of like they're working separate and off the same roadmap, and sometimes one team implements it before the other.
Does Office for the Mac still lack macros?
It does, because it can't do VBS.
Okay.
But what it can do that's kind of interesting is in PowerPoint, it can do suggested layouts and smart arts that are way better than the Windows version. So I've gone through this semester and taken some of my PowerPoint slideshows for different classes that have been really basic, you know, just white background and the three, you know, the bullet point list. And it'll give me little suggestions like, hey, why don't you take these three bullet points and separate them into blocks with a little, a little pictogram on there. So it'll actually, if I talk about ask for help, it'll put a little question mark pictogram in. So it's kind of cool that it builds that that level of suggest ability in to your presentation.
That was weird. My Apple Watch, oh, no wonder. It kind of went... kind of vibrated, and then I got a text message.
Ah.
Yeah. Anyway.
It was just annoying you.
Yeah. So.
Speaking. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, it's funny. I have an Office 365 subscription, you know, the personal one, whatever it's called, the $100 a year one, but I've never installed it on my Mac. I don't know. Actually, I have a need, but I don't know. I don't know if I can do it on a Mac or even in Windows. I looked it up. I need to make like a multi-page sign, you know, like four sheets of paper and arranged in a rectangle. And I think I can do it in Office, but I'm not sure if I have to use the Windows version or not. I should go look it up. But at any rate. Okay, I'm really interested in the next thing you have on the list, this Apple Health Face, Apple Watch Health Face.
Yeah, so you were, we both have an Apple Watch. You just mentioned yours.
Yep.
So one of the things that Apple Watch debuted in the Series 4 is a new infographic watch face that looks like it's an analog clock, but it's got a ton of different areas for complications. And one of them that people realized is that you could actually put a digital readout above... right in the middle at the top, kind of centered. And that's great if you are like me and it takes you slightly longer to read an analog watch than it should.
It does.
I think I'm very ruined by digital.
Yes,
same
here.
The problem is the clock hands go over it. If they're, you know, if it's like 10 to 12 or something like that, the clock hands are over the time and you have to go back to the Stone Age of reading. Well, HealthBase is an app that is basically designed to let you get into your health data quickly, but it also has very, very robust complication support. You can fine-tune the complications for any of the watch faces. You can have it use whatever piece of information you want. You can. It just has a lot of robust complication features, and one of those is to put a digital readout on the infographic watch face over the ticks on the basically between 11:55 and 12:05. So it's kind of hard to explain what this looks like. However, I will I'll try to show an example of it. I'll actually take a couple of screenshots that we can put in with the podcast.
Okay.
But suffice it to say, if you are thinking, gee, I wish there was a way on the infographic face or any other face to add in a digital readout, they might be a good source. You can also put text in there, too. So if you have a inspirational phrase or something that you would like to always see when you look at your watch, that might be a good way to do it.
I'm wondering if I'm looking at the right one now. So I'm looking at an app, a watch app called HealthFace. Apple Watch. Is it made by a company called Crunchy Bagel? Am I looking at the right one?
Let me look.
I think I'm looking at the wrong one. I put in a link in our show notes, but I think I may have grabbed the wrong one.
Nope, that's the right one.
That's the right one? Okay.
Yep.
So, so it's straight, it gets data from HealthKit. Okay, I see. So if you have, because it talks about glucose and insulin levels, and
yeah.
Are there any HealthKit devices that do stuff like that yet?
I thought that was I'm not sure. I think that it mostly could also be that you could use it to quickly add those yourself.
Oh, do it manually.
So if you have a glucose monitor or something like that and you want to quickly be able to add those things.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of showing you, this is what the Apple Watch can put there natively on the infographic. It can put that right there. But HealthFace will let you actually put it in the arc of the numbers.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Because they don't show that on their website. They don't show that
ability. It's a relatively new feature.
Yeah.
In fact, when they first debuted it only had 24-hour time.
Yeah.
And I actually sent a piece of feedback into the developer and said, hey, can you consider putting 12-hour? And then they did so. So it's a relatively new feature, and I think they're probably getting a lot of sales because people really want to be able to customize a little bit more. I think it's only... I hope it's only a matter of time before Apple really allows you to do whatever you want with your watch faces and custom watch face design, but they're still highly protective of that. And every year at WWDC, I kind of hope that maybe this is the year we get customized watch faces.
Yeah, it's too bad because, you know, I really enjoy the various third-party watch faces from my old Motorola 360. That was, the watch didn't last very long, but... While I had it, I really, really got a lot of enjoyment out of those various watch faces, including the custom photo ones and a bunch of chronographs I bought. Actually, bought a few watch faces. So this one is $1.99, US $1.99, from a company called Crunchy Bagel. And it requires iOS 10 or later. Does it work on anything other than a Watch Series 4? Can you run it?
Yeah, it'll work on any of the watch series, but to get that infographic analog face, you need watchOS. You need a Series 4 for that.
Oh, okay.
But you can still run it on any other watch face that your watch has. And if it's got enough space to do a digital readout, it'll do a digital readout.
Nice. Okie dokie. All right. And let's see. Oh, you got some screenshots there. Okay, now... I have a rant, and that rant is, I have a paid Outlook.com account, and you can't do it anymore. It was only available for 1 year. I paid, you know, whatever it is, $25 a year or something, and it let me shunt one of my old IMAP4 mail feeds over to it, and it works great. as you know, as far as that goes. But lately, the junk mail filter looks completely broken. I'm getting so much junk mail. And not even all of it is in English. So, you know, I can't even read what some of the junk mail is. Although I know it's junk mail from, like, the pictures I see and things like that.
It just looks junky.
So, in the unlikely event that Microsoft's actually listening, doubtful, but still, Outlook.com's junk mail filter is broken. All right.
You know, it brings up an interesting point that I don't even know half the time where my mail is being filtered. Because you think about it, I have email that goes through Gmail. They have their own filters.
Right.
Then I've got Apple Mail, which does some of its own junk mail filtering.
Right.
Outlook does some filtering, some rudimentary filtering, especially when it comes to what it decides to put in the focused inbox versus the regular inbox, which, right, like I've said in the past, I think I'm the only person on the planet that that works for, and I've accepted that.
Yeah, I don't like focused inbox
anymore. And then there's this weird thing with corporate email now, where it's hard to tell if your corporate email server slapped a header on there or if the senders did.
Huh.
So, and then add in mailing lists that span multiple corporate networks, and you can really get confused very quickly. So it's an interesting world where if you're really confused, you might spend a lot of time analyzing email headers just to figure out which email server gave a spam score or appended something like, you know, commercial solicitation to the subject line and all of those things.
Well, I can tell you something about Outlook's mail filter. It doesn't do any of the above because it's letting it all through.
Well, that's, you know, sometimes that's good. When I used to do tech support for a web hosting company, I was the guy that had to fix the email server whenever it went down.
Oh, yuck.
And part of that meant, part of that meant learning how to talk directly to an email server. So, you know, through Telnet.
Logging to port 25 or whatever
it was. Yeah, logging into port 25 and saying hello to it, and, you know.
With one L.
Yeah, sometimes that was the quickest way to send a test email, was to directly, because you're already in a command line. So I got really good at getting annoyed when my headers would get messed up and mucked around and all of that. I remember my favorite thing that I duct taped together was we had an issue where we were running a piece of software called iMail, which is a mail server that basically hasn't been in development for 10 years, 20 years. So this was about 10 years ago. So it was kind of at the end of its operational life cycle.
Yeah, it's the Dukem Nukem of mail.
Yeah, yeah. So iMail, the queue, like many mail servers, would get just stalled. And you'd go, well, gee, no email's been coming through. That's weird.
Yeah.
And you'd log into the box, and there would be, I don't know, 15, 20,000 emails in the queue just waiting for something to happen. And of course, if you then restarted the queue manager and restarted the cooler, nothing would happen because now there was way too much in the queue directory. So you'd have to spoon feed the queue directory. You'd have to take all the files out and then slowly start moving them back in. And it was a royal pain. So I actually wrote a script that ran on one of our Linux boxes that would send a test email to the mail server, or through the mail server. No, it would go through an external mail server so that we knew for sure it was going out. Then it would get received by our gateway server that did all the spam filtering, and then it would get passed on to the actual mail server where the user mailboxes were, and then from there it would get forwarded back to that same Linux web server that started it out.
Yikes.
And it would basically take a timestamp and compare. It would basically write a timestamp in when it sent it and then compare it to a timestamp when it got it. And it was the craziest thing. It would run every, like, it would start its path on the 5th of every, 5 minutes after, 10 minutes after, 50 minutes after. And then it would check for itself on, like, the 8th multiple after that.
Yeah.
But that worked for embarrassingly a long time before it broke itself. But that was how we could tell within 10, 15 minutes if the mail server had started to gum up. And by that point, usually a quick restart of the spooler would be enough to get it back going. You wouldn't have to go through the trouble of spoon feeding it like we used to. But Mail servers are ornery, ornery beasts, and I'm very glad that I don't have to manage them anymore.
Yep, ditto, ditto. Almost all servers are ornery beasts, in my opinion, but especially these days.
I got really good at that time troubleshooting Microsoft's Internet Information Server, you know, IIS.
IIS, yeah.
And ASP pages and ASP.NET. Man, I'm really glad I don't do that on a full-time basis anymore. Being a professor of psychology, I don't have to do these things, and that's helpful.
I used to use Linux boxes for my servers, so my preferred web server of choice was Apache, HTTPD. It had its moments, especially when you needed to harden the system, but we won't go there, because that is a long, sad story. Okay, the last thing I think I'd like to just briefly discuss is, you know, today is Easter Sunday in the U.S., and there have been a horrific series of explosions in Sri Lanka, and I don't know enough about what's going on there to comment on any of that. But what I did read is that as a result of these explosions, the Sri Lankan government has blocked social media and imposed a curfew. You know, to prevent the spread of misinformation. And so John and I were talking about it before the podcast, and like I said, I don't think either of us know enough about the situation there to comment on that, what's actually happening. But we were interested in the tech aspect of it, is, you know, blocking social networking sites. And the ones specifically mentioned is they've blocked access to Facebook. And I think further on in the article, I think I saw a few other services that were also blocked. And one of the things John mentioned earlier is that, hey, you know, if they were using the Mastodon decentralized system that Ryan Ozawa was on talking about with us a few weeks ago, you know, would that still happen? As I answer, I don't know. I don't know. But it is sort of interesting. And you wonder what would happen here if we had another... you know, sort of horrific event, as we did on 9/11, for example, if we would see our social media sites blocked or whatever. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's from, you know, separating the politics out and just thinking about it from a technological standpoint, it is a very interesting thing to consider. Why decentralizing our social media, which is obviously something Ryan was sort of advocating for when he was on a few weeks back, why it might not be a bad idea, and why we might want to think about it in the near future.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, because if you remember that day, you know, 9/11, 2001, we didn't really have Twitter and Facebook. I don't know if MySpace is around there, probably not, but we didn't have the social media type of sites that we have now, way back then, you know, 18 years ago, almost 18 years ago now. All we had were websites, and quite frankly, most websites crashed under the pressure of the volume of people trying to get information. In fact, I remember, and this is sort of interesting in a way, in talking about social media, I mean, the only site I remember I could get any news from at all, any information at all, was Slashdot. And that's because Slashdot, for those of you who remember, Slashdot was a, well, I guess it's still around, but Slashdot is a sort of a social news site. It was sort of very unique at the time, where people would contribute news ideas and the human editors at Slashdot would pick them out, I think, and highlight them in the feed, and there'd be a whole slew of comments. I mean, one of the other things was, you know, back when we didn't have social media, it was a social site, where people would comment on, you know, mostly technology items. And in fact, one of the effects was it became so popular during its time that if your news item, if your site was mentioned on it, sometimes your site would go down because so many people would run over from Slashdot to go see whatever it is they talked about on Slashdot, and it would bring your site down because your server wasn't set up. You know, this is before Amazon Web Services, right? You can't scale massively for a sudden surge. And you'd be Slashdot and you'd go down. But at any rate, so Slashdot was up, and it not only had little bits of news items from various places, but it also had discussion. It was the only place I remember that I could get any information. And one wonders what would happen today, you know. I mean, we've had lots of bad events, unfortunately, since then. But
yeah.
And hopefully we can scale better. But we have seen sites go down, not necessarily from volume, I think. I'm trying to remember the last time I saw a large-scale site go down because of volume. But we do see things like Apple.com slowing down when a new product comes out. I think we've seen Amazon, a couple of Amazon Primes ago, couldn't handle the flood of people trying to order. So even with scaling technology, it is still possible to at least slow down systems, if not bring it to a halt. But to do it on purpose, that's sort of interesting. And, you know, hopefully we'll never experience it here, but you can never tell. Anyway, that's my soapbox.
Very true.
Just wondering what's going on. Thoughts, John?
Basically, it's funny that you had to explain Slashdot.
Yes.
I guess there are people that... And if you're curious, the whole reason it's named Slashdot is so that it would be annoying to have to say to someone. Because back when you used to have to, you know, read web addresses off to people, it would be http://.com. So yeah, you'd have to know what they were talking about in order to know to spell out that slash dot. But it is something I hope that we will not have to experience in the United States.
Yeah.
I hope there's not something on that level of national emergency. I think the closest thing we come to is when AWS or Azure or any of the big back ends go down for any length of time. My students know that I use cloud storage quite a bit at work because I've got PowerPoint slides and things like that I don't really feel like carrying around on a jump drive because they're not backed up. So all the classroom PCs run Windows 10, and my computer in my office runs Mac OS, but they all use OneDrive, and so I can save something on my computer and then walk to the classroom, log in. OneDrive set up to sync to my directory there, so I can just open a file. And this works flawlessly, except when it doesn't. last Thursday, OneDrive was having connectivity issues.
Oh, really?
And I couldn't get it through the OneDrive app, and then when I logged in through the website, it couldn't get to my OneDrive, so obviously my storage server was down. So I reached in my pocket and pulled out a Swiss Army knife I have that has a USB drive on it. And said, oh, I'll be right back. And walked back over to my office and plugged it in and copied the file and then got back over and plugged it into the computer and opened it up. So, yeah, cloud storage, clouds are great. Computer networks are great until they don't work. And then you always need to have some sort of backup.
Yeah, I know people who still carry paper around just in case. And you know what? Sometimes you really do need it. You know, they'll like, go, well, I'm going to go give a talk, but I'm going to carry my paper version of my PowerPoint slides just in case.
Yeah. I always, that's why I like this little Swiss Army knife. It's one of the last ones that Victorinox actually has with a USB drive in it. And because it was very popular for a while to have USB drives in them.
Yeah, they're expensive.
This one has the essentials. It's got the USB drive. It's got a little pair of scissors, a pen, a light, and a little blade.
So you can't carry it. You can't carry it on board to a plane.
No, you would not be able to. But if you don't fly that often, like I do not, it's not that bad. But it is really funny how this is of all the random junk that you can have on your Swiss Army knife. This is about the most useful one I've ever found. Because
I always wanted one, but it was always too expensive for the number of gigs of storage. I think like a 4 gig version was super expensive, as I recall.
They kind of are.
That said, I have to tell you, I just realized I don't know how to pronounce that brand name either. I know what you're talking about. So for people who are into Swiss Army knives, there are different brands. And for people, I believe this. I'm not sure everybody believes this. I believe that the best brand... And I don't think John and I have any relationship to this company except we've bought their products, is what John just said. I always thought it was pronounced Victorinox, but when you said it, I said,
well,
John might be right.
looking looking at it, it is, I think it is Victory Knox.
Victory Knox, yeah.
It's V-I-C-T-O-R, so we got Victor. Inox, I-N-O-X, so it's a Victor Inox, Victor Enox, Victor Knox, whatever.
Yeah, maybe it's Victor or something. We should go look it up on YouTube later and figure out how it is.
And for all we know, the V is silent and it's Ichternox or something like that. So we are not to be trusted.
No.
When it comes to these sorts of things.
But yeah.
I just put a link in our show notes to the one I am speaking of, Todd, if you are interested, the one that I do believe works. But you are right. It is expensive for the amount of storage you get. It's a 16 gigabyte USB drive, which is pretty low storage.
Yeah.
And it's $65
yeah.
for the whole thing. So it's.
But you get the other stuff too. So there you go.
Yes.
Yeah. All righty. Okay. And with that, somehow we once again managed to fill up over 30 minutes, actually 45 minutes. When John and I started, before we started, I told John, I think it's going to be a really short one, like 10 minutes, but. It is not. Anyway, we are done. Mobileview's Podcats, 292. Mm-hmm. And if you've never had, I'm not a real cat person, but I'm sure a Podcats would be really good animal. All right. Yep. And with that, we bring podcast number 292 to an end. Hey, we're almost at 300. We'll talk to you later.